Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show, here on this Thursday, March 7th, 2024, just after 1 o'clock Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. in the beautiful, albeit somewhat kooky, province of British Columbia. And no, I won't leave you Maritimers out. It is 2 o'clock in Atlantic Canada, save for Newfoundland, where you get a jump on the rest of us at 2:30. That makes, Manitoba. I promise I wouldn't make fun of Manitoba anymore. It is Manitoba noon hour, a lunchtime in Manitoba, a province that is the only one I have not yet visited in the country. So if you can come up with a reason I should go there, please do. My one colleague who is formerly of Manitoba says that I should just avoid it on principle now and see how long I can go. But anyway, the polar bears look lovely up in Churchill. So all of that notwithstanding, it is great to have you tuned into the show. We'll be continuing our coverage of the Liberal government's Online Harms Act, Bill C-63, a little bit later on with law professor Bruce Pardy, who I suspect, if past interviews are an indication of future comments, will be very, very much for this. He loves censorship. No, he doesn't. He's more of a radical libertarian than I am. So Bruce and I, he's the only one that outflanks me on stuff like that. So we'll have a great chat later on. And also Jamil Javani, the Member of Parliament elect for Durham, he'll be joining us for his first post-election interview on True North. That will be in, I think, just after 1:30. So just about 27 minutes from now, we'll have Jamil on. But I wanted to begin with a bit of the bigger picture on Canadian politics right now, because you can always tell when a government or a party is beleaguered or embattled, because they tend to start being really desperate and really unhinged. Now, we have seen in polling for several months now that the Liberals have their backs up against the wall. They are not only facing a polling that shows Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives in majority territory, but they are finding themselves in some cases flirting with the NDP for that coveted third place spot. The spot that the Liberals went down to fourth place in 2011, but basically they are behind in some polls or almost behind the NDP. Sean says the Bloc is third right now. So that is actually going to be quite fascinating. Oh, in the House, yeah. So that's going to be quite interesting about whether the Liberals actually get down below the NDP. And in seat count, they could actually end up, as Sean says, right now below the Bloc because of the distribution. The Bloc has a much more efficient vote in Quebec. So if the Liberals are polling third overall, I don't want to get too much into the numbers, but they could still be behind the Bloc in seats. So We'll keep an eye out for that. But I'm less interested in the poll numbers and more interested in how the Liberals have decided to respond to them. Because we see them just getting really desperate right now. And what are the things the Liberals love to do? They love importing American battles. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, a decision that had zero effect whatsoever on Canada and Canadian abortion access and abortion laws, the Liberals started campaigning against the Roe v. Wade overturning. They had their crack squad of women's rights activists coming out to talk about this unprecedented assault on women's rights as though it has any effect on Canada whatsoever. The purpose is solely to wedge the Conservatives to try to bait one of the pro-life Conservative MPs into speaking about this. And this is why, I mean, I've been on the team that the election is not going to be until 2025. That's been the operating assumption I've had. But the one exception to that is, and it's a theory that's not original. Someone else brought this idea to me, but I can't remember who it was, so I'm going to claim credit for it. The Liberals may want to run in 2024 because they may wish to do what we're already seeing them start to do now, which is try to link Pierre Poilievre with Donald Trump. This is like the number one playbook for the Liberals, to try to link the relatively moderate Conservative Party of Canada with the evil, scary, right-wing, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, hate-mongery Republican Party in the United States. And if they could have a Canadian election overlapping with an American election, that will be a lot easier for them to do. We already see them trying to this. We'll start with this just stellar graphic. This is the far right American one, Sean. There we go. So Pierre Poilievre, this is the Liberal Party's official comms page. Pierre Poilievre is bringing far right American style politics to Canada. They cite a Toronto Star article, which, as we know, is the authority on all truth, the oracle of Canadian political wisdom. Pierre Poilievre wants to look tough, but bows to Donald Trump. Yeah, okay, there you go. And you even have the scary black and white picture of Pierre Poilievre right beside Donald Trump. It's terrifying, is it not? And then let's throw up the other one here. This is, again, this is stellar liberal comms. It is a screenshot from an iPhone note. And it's Pierre Poilievre. Oh, no. It's far right American, but they've crossed out far right American because Pierre Poilievre, for a moment, thought he was far right American. And then he realized he was actually Pierre Poilievre. Very, very witty and incisive here. Pierre Poilievre's priorities. Oh, no, put that back up. Deny climate change, cut services to cut taxes for the wealthy, gut the middle class, weaken gun control. Now, the reason I want that up still, they don't even get their metaphor right, because you see they've actually put X's beside them as if to say he has not done those things. So Pierre Poilievre hasn't denied climate change. He hasn't cut services to cut taxes to the wealthy. They should have done check marks, but that would just be relying on and requiring just a little bit too much sense from the Liberals. All right, we can take down the graphic now. This is going to be the only thing they're capable of doing. We know it because this goes back to the election that Andrew Scheer contested in 2019, Aaron O'Toole in 2021, all of Stephen Harper's elections. You go before that. It was the attacks against Stockwell Day and the Canadian Alliance, Preston Manning, and the Reform Party. And the reason I'm delving into the history a little bit here, you may recall on Monday I shared that I have a forthcoming biography of Pierre Poilievre. It's called Pierre Poilievre, A Political Life. It's the so far first and only, to which I'm aware, biography of Pierre Poilievre. And you can get the details on that at Amazon or Sutherland House. But in the course of writing that, I've had to go back through the annals of conservative political history in this country. And I focus specifically on 1997 to, 2024, because that's the period in which Pierre Poilievre has been involved politically. But in doing so, I was reminded of just how the tricks are the same in every single election. The attacks are the same. The chant that people used to use against Preston Manning in 93 and 97 was racist, sexist, anti-gay, Preston Manning, go away. It's got a nice rhythm to it, got a nice cadence. It wasn't true then, and it's not true now. But it's the same attacks. People are going to say, racist, sexist, anti-gay, Poilievre, go away. That's going to be the line that they use, because the attacks do not change, which is why the only way to combat that is by having a politician that's going to flip the script and not be deferential and conciliatory and take on this appeasement approach to the media and to the left, which is what conservative leaders have tried and failed to do in the last two elections. So that's going to be the dynamic, and that will be why Pierre Poilievre, I think, has a very different experience in the election than his predecessors will if he holds firm. Because when the attacks were thrown against Scheer and O'Toole, their instinct was to just head for the hills. They wanted to do the ostrich thing, stick their head in the sand, hope it would go away, instead of flipping that script, instead of going on the offense, which you may not like. Maybe you don't think it's prime ministerial, but certainly the approaches to date have not worked and are unlikely to work again. In fact, I'd say it's impossible for them to work again. So all that the Liberals are left with is this desire to tone police. There was this hilarious exchange I want to share. This was from I forget the name of it. It was from one of the parliamentary committees yesterday that was looking into the ArriveCan scandal. ArriveCan, the app that gets millions upon millions upon millions of dollars to do very little work, to basically force Canadians who are coming into the country to subject themselves to this scrutinizing of their vaccine status, their testing status. And it's just a couple of guys in a basement that are getting rich off of this. Well, every other Canadian was forced to go along with this absurd thing. The Conservatives have taken it upon themselves to call this the Arrive scam. This is part, you may think it's a bit lame, but this is what political communications is about. Arrive scam. Well, the Liberals think that is just a little bit too offensive for their liking. Take a look at this exchange from committee yesterday.
I am very struck by the comments of my Liberal colleague regarding lack of trust in public institutions, as if public institutions can be trust in public institutions can be disconnected from an evaluation of their conduct. I think public institutions have to earn trust. Now, the Arrive scam scandal is an earth-shattering
point of order,
scandal. Massive.
Just one second,
point
Mr.
Order,
Janus,
Mr. Chair. Thought,
yes, Ms. Khalid, your point of order is.
When conservative colleagues call it an Arrive scam instead of an Arrive cam
now,
app,
Ms. Khalid, that is
impacting
that
the public
Ms.
trust. That Ms. is the crux
Ms.
of
Ms.
what
Khalid,
I was trying to get
Ms.
at.
Ms. Khalid, that is not a point of order. That is a term we're hearing both in this committee room, but also throughout Parliament Hill. Mr. Jenner, you have the floor. 4 minutes and 40 seconds, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, trigger warning, my comments will use the word Arrive scam. Arrive scam is impacting public trust because it's an earth-shattering scandal. It's pretty rich for Liberals like Ms. Khalid to talk about the need for public trust in institutions when they have presided over a massive decline
Point
in the
order,
effectiveness and the trustworthiness of public institutions and done nothing about
Mr.
it.
Mr. Genuis, just... now, Ms. Khalid, you are... No, you're not the next speaker, but go ahead. You have a point of order. It's a point of order, not a rebuttal.
I'd appreciate if Mr. Genuis did not try to malign me. I've already been dealing with a lot of hate mail
and a lot of threats
in my office based on what the Conservatives have done. I would appreciate if you didn't put another target in my back.
Thank you.
I love it. This is Ikra Khalid, who is, the second part is like calling it Arrive scam him calling out, her calling out, his use of the word Arrive scam subjects her to hate and threats or something like that, which is absurd. And then the crucial point at the beginning there, that it undermines trust in institutions when the Conservatives call it Arrive scam. That comment is many things. It's great comedy, but as John Williamson pointed out, it is not by any stretch a point of order. But this is what the Liberals would love to focus on. Again, I would say let's perhaps focus on the fact that you're trying to censor what Canadians say and do online, but instead they're like, they're already actually policing it. This is a perfect segue because Ikra Khalid is already showing there that she thinks that Arrive scam is a word that you shouldn't be able to use. And this is the member of parliament from a party, from a government that is trying to police what you say and do online. So maybe if she gets her way, Arrive scam will be an example of hate speech that Bill C-63 will not let you discuss. That may be the way that we go from here. But this is exactly why I've been talking about this and why I should probably do at some point a segment on this show. Maybe we'll do it next week where I just go through all of the things that the Liberals have said are hate. Just to give a sense of the things that they may feel are within the regulatory purview of Bill C-63. For example, officials from the Department of Justice yesterday said that, this is literally what they said. They said that comparing people to human excrement may be, in fact, a violation of online hate speech. So you could actually make a comparison of someone to human excrement, which, again, I don't believe is kind. I don't believe you should generally go after people and make these excremental comparisons. But if you compare people to excrement, that could prompt a hate speech probe. And also if you compare them to vermin. So if you think someone is a crappy person, or as Sean just called me, a rat bastard piece of crap. I don't know if we can say rat bastard piece of crap on the show and keep the clean tag on iTunes, but I've already said it. So rat bastard piece of crap. This could be hate speech. So Sean, if you want to file a human rights complaint against me, actually I could file it against you because you said it to me. Yeah, Sean just called me a rat bastard piece of crap in the in our show chat. So I am triggered and traumatized by this. So that is, I believe I get $20,000 under C-63, but he has to pay $50,000 to the receiver general. So Sean, you're out $70,000, which means you should think twice about your language. You should have that chill that we all hear about in the course of free speech. He wants to know if he can expense it now to True North. Well, No, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say no. So anyway, let's discuss this. Do we have Bruce Pardy? We do. So Bruce Pardy is a law professor. And as I said earlier, the one who outflanks me on my libertarianism, which is already too radical for some of you. So I don't know what you're going to make of him. You'll be calling him a rat bastard piece of crap before long. But it's always great to get his insights on this. Bruce, thank you for coming on the show. This is something you've been warning about for years. And I've quoted a presentation I heard you give at SAFS in London a few years ago about these sorts of things. And one of the ones that stands out is your claim that if something is illegal offline, it's illegal online. So this idea that we need a law to create this special category of online speech is in and of itself flawed, is it not?
Yes. Yes, entirely. Now, there might be a jurisdictional reason for the feds to pursue this because they don't generally have jurisdiction over civil rights. And so speech in general is mostly a provincial matter, but they have jurisdiction over telecommunications. So they're using that as a justification, a cover for essentially wanting to walk into the role of censoring our online speech, which is becoming a greater proportion of our speech in general all the time. So this is one way in which the feds are elbowing their way into a matter that the provinces traditionally have had the major role.
One of the things that I find so jarring about it, and I don't know how much you read into this briefing that Department of Justice officials gave, which was basically because they thought journalists weren't getting it and they just needed to be, you know, given some more of the state propaganda on this. But one of the things that I've really taken from this is that the government's leaning very heavily on the just trust us. They're saying, no, the Canadian Human Rights Commission will make sure that this isn't abused. That's the whole point of this, though, is that we're empowering these bureaucrats to decide what we can and can't say online.
Oh, exactly. So, you know, there have been many lawyers who, since the draft of the bill came out, have pointed out all the flaws, and they're absolutely right. But yes, so the trust in the administration to deal with the online platforms, the trust in the human rights mechanisms to make the right calls about where the line's supposed to be, and even the trust in the courts in defining what falls on one side and the other side of the idea of hate speech. But so one of my concerns about Bill 63, in addition to all of the very valid criticisms that it's received, I mean, it's a terrible draft. I mean, it cannot be let through. But an awful lot of those problems already exist, including the one that you just referred to. We already have a major portion of our law in the hands of these kinds of bodies, whether they're executive bodies or legal bodies per se. The lines drawn in our laws are terribly vague. So just take the most basic one. We have freedom of speech in Section 2 of our charter. What does that mean? Who knows? It's always up to the courts to decide. So when you think, well, I have freedom of speech because it says so in the charter, you don't actually know what that means. And so we've got a very basic problem in our law that this is making worse, to be sure. But we haven't attacked the actual problem.
Yeah, and it's so difficult because the whole point of speech regulations, for example, in the United Kingdom, they have a like in Canada, a broadcast regulator called Ofcom, and they have to adjudicate if you use a dirty word on television, whether that word was something you could say on TV before 9 o'clock, which is their watershed hour. And they publish this annual list of all the words they've said are violated. And it is actually hilarious because you read through this list and you learn of like slurs and swears that you didn't even know existed that some bureaucrat has just decided. But this list gets longer and longer every year because someone looks at it and makes a judgment call. And in the end, you have these absurd boundaries and borders. And you know, I've been making a point on this show of talking about this, what the government thinks is this uber clear delineation of it can't detest or vilify, but it can disdain, offend, hurt, harm. And they think that this is clarity, but it actually is no such thing.
No. And my guess is that they know there's no clear line there. That is simply to empower the kind of discretion that you're talking about. But remember, we have these kinds of restrictions in our laws already. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, this is adding to them, making them worse. It cannot stand. But we have a hate speech provision in the criminal code already that, for my money, shouldn't be there. We have restrictions on speech in various kinds of human rights codes across the country already. They shouldn't be there. And we've accepted them. And so this is just a piling on. It's a bad piling on. It needs to be defeated, but it's a piling on. We have accepted the idea that hate speech, whatever that happens to me, should be restricted. That, for my money, that is incorrect. If you live in a free country, you're allowed to hate other people. Now, we don't recommend it. It's not a good thing. We're not going to encourage it. But if you're free, you're allowed to, for the reason that you're free. And if that's what you think, then again, if you're free, you're allowed to say so, because that's what you think. And
well,
that,
I saw.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I saw you post on Twitter the other day something about that, which I found interesting. Whereas in the U.S., they've actually specifically protected hate speech. Whereas in Canada, we've done the opposite. So the U.S. doesn't have to deal with this question of where to draw the line. Whereas in Canada, we do.
That's right. And as a population, we seem to have accepted the idea that it's appropriate for the government to draw that line somewhere and tell us that we're not allowed to express our distaste for other people. Well, now you're being managed. And, you know, being free includes a lot of uncomfortable, ugly things. It involves a bit of chaos. So there's a choice here. It's been with us for a long time, and I think we are failing to choose correctly, but we are choosing to be managed for the sake of I don't know, for the sake of you know, civilizational manners, instead of deciding that actually, yeah, we are a free country. Right now, that's very much in doubt.
One of the most, I mean, generally speaking, a win is a win and a loss is a loss, but sometimes a win can be a loss. And by that, I'm referring to the Mike Ward case before the Supreme Court. This is a Quebec comedian that told a joke about a disabled teenager. Again, you may think this is incredibly in poor taste. You may think it's unfunny. You may think it's rude. You may think that people should boycott him, but he did this. His life was dragged through the ringer. Comedians would rather be performing and doing comedy, although he was subjected to more of a tragedy and a drama by going before the Quebec Human Rights Commission and all of that. And in the end, this goes to the Supreme Court of Canada. He wins, but it was a 5-4 decision. Now, the fact that it came down to one judge on whether you have a right to tell offensive jokes in this country is incredibly dangerous. And that's why I'm not all that pessimistic, or I'm not all that optimistic about C-63, because I think since the Ward case, there have been one, if not two, more appointments to the Supreme Court by Justin Trudeau. So that case today may end up being, you know, 7-2 or something.
Well, I totally agree with you on this, and I would go further. So yes, it was a 5-4 decision, but even the basis of the majority decision was not what you want. So basically they said, no, he's okay in this instance because, you know, he didn't intend to target this person on the basis of the prohibited ground. So in other words, if he had wanted to make fun of this person on the basis of a prohibited ground, maybe that would not have been okay. You know,
you're right. It's not even it wasn't even a free speech argument that the majority gave. It was no. Like he got off on it was the Al Capone tax evasion thing. He got off on the technicality.
That's right. And so we are missing a robust endorsement of the idea that you are free to say what you think, and the so-called perceived harm on others because of hearing your dreadful thoughts really should be irrelevant. And we have not gotten there yet.
Let me go out to the bigger picture here, because you and I have had many discussions on this show and elsewhere where we've lamented the state of things in Canada. And are you and I advocating for something that is fundamentally not what the law in Canada is supposed to be? And by that, I mean, is this an issue where the law has been designed in a way and it's just diverged so far from that point? Or are we in the wrong country? Has this actually been a case of Canada was never meant to have very robust freedom of expression?
Well, this is a question that has no clear resolution, right? I mean, some people would say the former, and that our tradition has not been like that in the U.S. And of course, you know, U.S. jurisprudence on freedom of speech has come in peaks and valleys as well. It's not, you know, black and white. It was not one thing from the very beginning. But their First Amendment and our Section 2 basically both say people have freedom of speech. And the words are very vague. And they, in neither case, do they exactly say what that means. And it just so happens that it's played out one way in the U.S. and the other way in Canada. So there's nothing inherent in our provisions that suggests that we ought not to have free speech. But our institutions, our legal institutions, our courts in particular, but also our governments, have insisted that that's actually not the case in this country.
Beverly McLaughlin, the former Chief Justice, did an interview the other day, and I haven't watched the whole thing, but I read little snippets of it, and it sounds like she's generally supportive of Bill C-63 and what it tries to do, and the issues that she flags are ones that are more like, well, you know, I might be concerned if. And it's quite interesting, because that aligns with what I expect from Beverly McLaughlin. But if you look at some past decisions, I mean, she used to be quite strong on freedom of expression, and it's amazing that there's been this flip where it's only freedom of expression for certain people now and for certain groups. And I mean, she, I think, would be mortified by some of the things she's said in the past about it. I mean, I she's defended the right to deny the Holocaust, but now the right to misgender someone. I don't know.
Yes, you'd think that a former version of herself might be appalled with what the present version of herself is saying. maybe. But it is also the case, though, that even at the Supreme Court and even from Beverly McLaughlin, the justification for free speech has sometimes run along the lines of, well, we need free speech because it's effective. It's important to maintain our democracy for the you know, free marketplace of ideas. To get to the truth, we need yada, yada, yada. And that's good. That's fine. That's true.
But it's a very utilitarian argument. It's
extremely utilitarian. And so the implication is, look, if it doesn't benefit the society to have this, then you can't have it. And that is not what free means. Free means you can say what you think because you think it and for no other reason.
Wow. Yeah, and there was a quote I was hoping you would talk for 10 seconds longer so I could pull up the quote. I'll paraphrase it in the absence of that, because Beverly McLaughlin had said in a speech at some point that her job as a judge was to take a step back and after hearing a case and decide what's best for society. Which, right. It's entirely par for, I think, how the Supreme Court deals with these things, but very dangerous in kind of on the back end of what you've just said there, which is that you have judges that all of a sudden start looking at speech as a tool instead of speech as an inherent good and free speech as an inherent good. And that, I think, is exactly especially right. Concerning when you go up against these equality rights in the charter, and all of a sudden you're going to get a judge that's saying, well, yes, but your freedom of speech isn't good if it makes someone feel unsafe because of their gender identity or their race or whatever this case is.
Yes. And we should note how that changes the idea of the nature of rights, right? Mm-hmm. For my money, the whole idea was that these were lines in the sand where the group could not invade the ability of the individual to do as he chose. But now these rights are being interpreted through the lens that you're describing, which is, well, the right is okay as long as it serves society. Well, but that's completely the opposite of the first idea. The an individual right has to stand regardless of its effect upon society, for the very reason that it is an individual right and not a societal right.
All right, we'll end on a lighter note, Bruce. Who do you think is getting hauled before the tribunal first, you or me?
Oh, geez. Well, you talk more frequently than I do, Andrew, so I'd have to go with you.
All right. Well, I'll get you as my counsel of record then when it happens. Bruce Pardee, the executive director of Rights Probe, law professor at Queen's University. Always a pleasure, Bruce. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Andrew. Cheers.
All right. I'm glad Bruce is always like the downer when I have him on. And he was surprisingly chipper today, which I quite like. So now, that being said, the bill hasn't yet become a law. So who knows what will happen then. Nevertheless, I mentioned earlier this week, there was a big win in Durham. Not altogether unsurprising, as I said, and I put the caveat there, because it has been a conservative stronghold for 20 years. But the margin of victory by which the conservative candidate, Jamil Javani, won was actually quite strong. And I think there is a message in this to Justin Trudeau, either that conservatives are in fact looking beyond, or conservative voters, voters in general, are looking beyond all those evil, scary conservative Trump comparisons. And also that the liberal vote is just not motivated to show up. People that voted for Justin Trudeau in the last three elections, and especially the last one election, are just not motivated to show up and do it again. So there's a lot to unpack there, but I'd rather focus on the guy himself. We've had him on the show in the past on a number of occasions in a number of different capacities, both as a broadcaster, as president of the Canada Strong and Free Network, and now as the MP-elect for Durham. Jamil Javani, good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on and congratulations.
Thank you, Andrew. It's always good to chat with you. And being called an MP is still something I got to get used to. So,
well, MP-elect, I don't want to jump the gun too much formality. Do you know when you are going to be sworn in?
I don't know yet. No. So Elections Canada still has to go through their process of ratification and stuff. So once that's done, that's when we can schedule the swearing in. So we're sort of in their hands for the moment, but it'll be soon.
It must be very exciting. I know you've gone through in the last few years a lot of change. I mean, you've had to deal with cancer. You obviously got fired from Bell. You turned around and tried to, and I think successfully, stick it to Bell with a lawsuit. You've taken over the Canada Strong and Free Network for a time. Like, how do you begin to sort of decide what to do now when you get to Ottawa?
Well, I mean, the good thing about this job is that we were elected to accomplish the goals that we set out. So that's what I think our focus is. You know, it was a 12-word promise that we made many, many times during the campaign, which is axe the tax, build the homes, fix the budget, stop the crime. That is the agenda. And certainly at this point, where our job is to hold the current government to account, we want to focus as much as we can on pushing for ideas that we think are going to help accomplish those objectives. And also for me locally, you know, here in Durham, to make sure that I'm a good, strong voice for the issues that people care about. We knocked on over 111,000 doors in the last few months. And so I've talked to as many of our voters as possible, as many of our community members as possible. And I think I have a sense of what they want from me as the MP. And that's what I'm out here to do.
One of the questions that always comes up in politics is how much of a candidate's performance is them and how much is the leader? And you can never quantify it, but I'm curious if you got a sense when you were out knocking on doors how Pierre Poilievre is perceived, or if he's even perceived by people. Because obviously there's been a bit of a change. This riding was formerly represented by Aaron O'Toole, who was the previous Conservative leader. We get from the media no shortage of claims about, you know, Pierre Poilievre being the big, evil, scary Conservative meanie. How was that actually on the ground when you were talking to voters?
Well, I think people are very happy with what they've seen from, you know, Pierre Poilievre up till this point. You know, since he became leader of the party, I think a lot of folks unhappy with our current government and unhappy with our current economy in particular see Pierre as the change leader. That if you want something other than Trudeau, if you want an economy that, as we say, works for those who do the work, that is actually responsive to the needs of middle class and working class families, that Pierre is the guy to make that change happen. So on the ground, a lot of support for Pierre, a growing amount of support as people get to know him better. And the reality is that, you know, the reason we won by the big margin that we did, the biggest margin in the 20-year history of the Conservative Party of Canada in Durham, was won by us on Monday. And I think that is because, you know, Pierre Poilievre has become a symbol of change for people. So we drew support from neighborhoods that Conservative Party in candidates in the past may not have been able to get as much support from, because we are now seen as the change party. So that's a very exciting thing for us, you know, nationally, but also locally, it's very exciting because I think people have expectations for us that we're going to deliver. And now it's on us to actually hold up our end of the deal.
You made some waves on Monday night when you took aim at liberal elites, which I played the clip on the show, and I think the audience was very much on your side on that one. But I was curious in who you included in that, because you weren't just talking about the capital L Liberal Party led by Justin Trudeau. You talked about telecom companies. You even talked about, I mean, what I read as the Ontario PC government. Did you not?
Well, I specifically mentioned the Ontario Ministry of Education, because I mean, the facts just bear it out. They have upheld a policy agenda that is very similar to what you might have seen with a Liberal government in power. They have focused on a lot of virtue signaling. They have focused on race politics. Meanwhile, the average student in Ontario is still struggling with math, with reading, with writing. They have tried very hard to do, in my view, superficial things, while the effects of pandemic school closures are still being felt by middle class and working class families. You know, my job as an MP is to care about what people in Durham care about. And I'm knocking on doors, I'm talking to parents every day, I'm talking to students every day, and they're telling me the school system isn't working for us. So I feel it's important to tell the truth. And when I say liberal elite, you're absolutely right, Andrew. I'm not just talking about people who are in one political party. A lot of our voters were former Liberal voters, and I don't hold them in contempt, because I grew up in a community where I was taught the Liberal Party is where you belong. And it took me a while to figure out that that wasn't true. And it might take others a while to figure out that out too. So I don't hold that against people. But when I talk about liberal elites, I'm talking about the people who have abandoned the middle class and the working class. And I, as I said, whether they're big bank CEOs, big telecom CEOs, the Ministry of Education, the activists and academics pushing for, you know, anti-law enforcement, anti-public safety policies. What all of these folks have in common is that they are serving a privileged few while turning their backs on the majority of people in this country. And I got to tell the truth about that. And if it ruffles feathers and it makes people unhappy, get used to it, because my job is to work for the people of Durham. My job is not to worry about offending people in the halls of power who are actually making everybody's life harder.
One of the things you and I have spoken about this in the past, and I know you've spoken about it in speeches, when you were at Bell as a radio host, there was kind of an expectation that was put on you that because you fit a certain demographic mold, you would fit an ideological mold as well. And I know that was one of the things you took aim at when you spoke out against them. And I can't help but notice that the narrative around you and your candidacy would be different if you had a different political view. Like, I'm convinced, and you may disagree with me, Jamil, that if you were a liberal, you would be getting like the New York Times style profile of, you know, this bootstrap guy that got himself into Yale and is now trying to change the country. But just to give you one headline from the Globe and Mail, Jamil Giovanni will fit right in with activist populist conservatism of Polyev. So you just basically get distilled down into this. And I'm curious what you think of the media's take on you. I mean, did they really cover you, and did they cover you fairly?
Well, I do not expect fairness from the media. It's a lesson I learned even before I worked in it, but certainly when working in it and just seeing all the pressure put on employees by these big media corporations to serve a certain agenda. You know, it's not easy to be fair in the media. You do have to sometimes put your career on the line, because you've got management who doesn't want you to be fair and doesn't want you to be impartial and objective. So I don't expect it to be fair. The truth is this: if you want to make a difference in this country right now, you have to fight for the middle class. You have to fight for the working class. You got to fight for the people who are not represented in the media. They don't work in the media. It, by virtue of the type of training and education and lifestyle that the media rewards, the voices of the middle class and the working class are often not in these organizations, whether it's a radio station or a TV station. And there are exceptions to that, but by and large, it's just not the case. So just look at the polls. You know, in every poll that comes out, Pierre Polyev is at the top of the list, because many, many Canadians, a growing number, want change. But you don't see that reflected in news coverage, because they're out of touch. And our job is not to be beholden to out of touch media organizations. They can call me names. When Justin Trudeau was calling me names and a twofer and all that nonsense, most of these media organizations didn't cover that either. They're not interested in providing an objective view of what's happening. They have their own values. They have their own agenda. When I say liberal elites, I am talking about the companies that own many of the media outlets that Canadians rely on for information. So this is why I'm always keen to do independent media like True North, to do local media like we have here in Durham. We've got, you know, still a number of newspapers, TV stations, radio stations, because this is where you get a more accurate sense of what's going on in the country. And I'll tell you now, as the MP elect for Durham, that is wisdom I take into my new job. I will not be someone who's going to get pushed around by journalists who think if they give me bad coverage, I'm going to change my values. I was elected because of my values, and I will continue to stand for them.
Let me just ask you about where you have to direct your attention now, because, you know, unlike anyone who gets elected in a general election and has, you know, 2, 3, 4 years of breathing room, you're being elected in a by-election, which means you could, you could theoretically find yourself campaigning in like a month's time. It looks like it's probably going to be about a year and a half until the next election. But what pressure does that put on you to, you know, perform as an MP, to navigate this new life, this new world, like, you know, figuring out everything from where the bathrooms are on Parliament Hill to, you know, how you can get a bill passed, and then have to turn around and do it again?
Yeah, well, it's one thing that a lot of people might not know is that getting elected to Parliament, there are things you have to do just like with any other job. There's orientation, and there's the tech guy who has to explain how you use your phone and log into your new email address. Like, so there's a lot of those steps that I'm just figuring out now and trying to learn, you know, how it all works as quickly as I can. But, you know, the truth is that the fact that an election or general election could be coming so quickly is, you know, this is exactly why we have to stay close to our people, close to our voters, close to the community, because I'm not going to be surprised. I want to know what people want from their MP every step of the way. I'm not going to be one of those politicians who just comes and knocks on your door every few years. I want to be someone who the public feels this guy has our back. He's there to do a job. He works just as hard as we do, and we can trust him to speak for us. So that's the mentality I come into the job with. And that's why I have the confidence I have that, you know, we can take positions that the media might not like. We can stand for things that the Liberals are going to attack us on. They can throw all their darts and all their stones, all they want. And I'm fine to take it, because I really believe I have a sense of what people want, what the majority of people in our community here want. And that's what I'm trying to be accountable to.
Is there like a bucket list thing that you'd love to achieve in your first, I don't even want to call it a first term because it's like a partial term, but is there's something that you want to be able to get to the end of the next, you know, 12, 18 months and be able to say, I've done this, when you go to campaign for re-election?
Yeah, well, I guess there's two things I have in mind. One is, you know, I think nuclear energy is a really, really important part of the future of Canada. You know, we've been sort of sold this idea that, you know, free market economics and the climate have to be at odds with each other, that it's opened the gates to a lot of bad policies like the carbon tax. I don't support any of that. I mean, obviously, we campaign on axing the carbon tax all the time. But we do have, you know, lower emission options that will grow the economy, especially for us here in Ontario. And, you know, in my area in particular, there are over 3,000 people who are employed by our local nuclear plant. So I think nuclear energy is a really big part of the future, and I want to do my part as an MP to push for that and get us away from this sort of anti, you know, free market, anti-economic growth approach that the Liberals have taken. And the other issue is I want to draw attention to some of the challenges facing boys and young men in our society. You know, Andrew, I commend you a great deal because you've been open with some of the challenges you faced as a man. Mental health is one of the biggest things that are going on, that are happening with boys and young men. We often don't talk about it. Often there aren't services available to a lot of us. And I think we need to make sure that, you know, the funding that goes out to programming in our communities is accounting for the fact that, you know, the vast majority of people who are committing suicide, the vast majority of people who are dying from overdoses, these are men. And I think that their stories need to be told and heard. And I know a lot of moms and grandmas who are expecting me to stand up for their sons and their grandsons. So that's a big part of what I'd like to accomplish early on in this part of my journey as well.
Well, and I'm glad. Yeah, you did tremendous work as an author on that file. And I hope you pick that up as a member of Parliament. And obviously, I'm available if you need anything. But you've got that you seem to have that well handled. And I look forward to hearing what you do with that. So MP-elect for Durham, Jamil Javani, it's great to talk to you. And congratulations again.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And I'm very happy for your continued success. And I'm a big fan of the show. So always happy to be here.
Oh, it's a good thing you didn't say that before the election. You never would have won with an endorsement like that. Thanks a lot, Jamil.
Take care.
You can always tell if someone is true to themselves if they will talk to independent media. That's what I always say. Well, I've said it once, but and that was right now. So anyway, thanks again to Jamil Javani for coming on the show. And I seem to have a lot of fans in the comments there as well. So hopefully we'll get him back once he's in Ottawa and tackling all of the things he wants to tackle. But with that, I will say farewell for today. We are going to be back with Off the Record tomorrow, which you won't want to miss. I don't even know who's on Off the Record tomorrow. It's me and Candace Malcolm, and I don't know, I think Rachel Emanuel is doing it, but you'll have to tune in to figure that out, and we'll see you then. And of course, the Andrew Lawton Show returns on Monday. So have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to the Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.